We've gone through a lot in this country over the years. The assassination of a president, resignation of another one, and so much more. Richard Nixon, he was the 37th president of the United States. He served from 69 to 1974 when he became the only president to resign the office. Listen in.
I have never been a quitter. To leave office before my term is completed is abhorrent to every instinct in my body. But as president, I must put the interests of America first. America needs a full-time president and a full-time Congress, particularly at this time with problems we face at home and abroad, to continue to fight through the months ahead for my personal vindication. Would almost totally absorb the time and attention of both the president and the Congress in a period when our entire focus should be on the great issues of peace abroad and prosperity without inflation at home. Therefore, I shall resign the presidency effective at noon tomorrow.
In a moment, Roger Stone joins me. He's back. His latest work, Nixon's Secrets, The Rise, Fall, and Untold Truth About the President, Watergate, and the Pardon. And welcome back to Coast. I'm George Norrie with our special guest tonight, Roger Stone, his latest work, Nixon's Secrets. But he also wrote a book called The Man Who Killed Kennedy, The Case Against LBJ. And you need to put this into perspective, because as that tragedy unfolded from 1963 into Nixon's election as president, you will find a lot when we talk tonight about Nixon's secrets, some of the ways that Nixon used that assassination to get to where he wanted. Roger, welcome back to the show. It's good to have you.
I am really delighted to be here. And you're absolutely right. This book is in many ways a sequel. It's the same cast of characters. That's what's so striking. Why are four of the Watergate burglars there on Dealey Plaza the fateful day that John F. Kennedy is murdered? I'm jumping many squares ahead, of course, but it is the continuing thread of history. What I've tried to do here is to connect the Operation 40 assassination attempts against Castro, which morphed into the Bay of Pigs operation, a fiasco, which is deeply related to the Kennedy assassination. The death of John Kennedy has the inadvertent effect of breathing life back into the political career of the dead political Richard Nixon, and Watergate is really connected to the very same people who took JFK out are involved in taking Nixon out and we'll go through their reasons. It's a continuing thread of history, and of course those are both related to the pardon. It's a long tale, but I think that I have. Working on the terrific work of others, I think I figured, this whole era out, and an era that Bob Dole himself called the era of Nixon.
You know, Roger, I after reading Nixon's Secrets and, of course, your earlier book, The Man Who Killed Kennedy, I'm amazed you're still walking around. You've got way too much knowledge about this.
Well, I think that's, this is a credential I think I bring to these books, which is I spent, 40 years in the corroded rectum of the two-party system. I saw politics as the down and dirty business it was. And my book is not a love letter to Nixon, nor is it an excoriation. It's an admiration, it's an appreciation, if you will, of an indomitable resilience, a stick-to-itiveness, just a driving dream to be president that he never lets go of, despite enormous disadvantages, setbacks, bad judgments, mistakes, and defeats. He still gets there. And when he's there, George, lost in the ashes is the fact that he does many great things that leave this a safer, more prosperous, and healthier world.
No question. Roger, I would have said that without Watergate, if that had never happened, he could have gone down in history as one of the best presidents we ever had.
Well, I think it's true. And one of the examinations in my book is really how the neocons, the rising neocons, who thought in Nixon they were going to get a super hardliner, were extremely turned off when they found out he wanted to get out of Vietnam as quickly as possible. He really sped up Vietnamization. He wanted to engage the Soviets in an arms control dialogue, and to do so, he wanted to go open relations with China to make sure that the Russians wanted to talk.
I will always remember that ping-pong diplomacy.
And the CIA and the Joint Chiefs and the NSC and Henry Kissinger, they were furious. Nixon had moved to the center. He was pro-peace. He was pro-détente. And as early as 1969, they begin spying on him. By that, I mean there is a military guy, a yeoman named Radford, who works in the military attaché's office in the White House. And at night, he is removing documents from file cabinets and desks. He even rifles through Henry Kissinger's briefcase, copying everything. And it's going it's going directly to the admiral he reports to, who in turn is giving it to Admiral Thomas Moore, the notoriously right-wing chairman of the Joint Chiefs. And they are not happy at Dick Nixon. He has sold out to the commies because he wants to pursue peace. They want to bomb Red China. He wants to buy and engage Red China in trade.
What I found amazing about your work, Nixon Secrets, Roger, was the fact that everybody was trying to get everybody out of political office. They wanted Spiro Agnew out. They wanted Nixon out. They wanted Ford out. They wanted Reagan out. I mean,
We will get to Agnew when we get to the discussion of the pardon, because Vice President Spiro T. Agnew, while not the most intelligent man you've ever met, was railroaded out of the way. They meaning the people who were really driven to remove Nixon from office, led by General Haig. Haig is a double agent. Haig is not Nixon's man when he becomes Nixon's chief of staff. He's working for the Joint Chiefs.
And Nixon never saw it coming, did he?
No, to this day, I think that many in the Nixon family don't recognize that this guy really walked the old man towards the exit in a series of stunning errors that can only be purposeful. Nixon's defense, when he gets in deep political hot water here, is really damaged.
Let's go back just a little bit on the basis of your first book, The Man Who Killed Kennedy.
Yes.
Where LBJ, of course, is implicated in this, because at that point, didn't Kennedy want LBJ out? He wasn't going to use him again in the 64 election, was he?
Well, he was really having no choice. Lyndon Johnson had become a major political liability because of the stench of corruption around him. He had two federal investigations that were closing in on him, Bobby Baker and the Billy Sol Estes investigation. Bobby Baker was Johnson's right-hand man in the Senate, really his bag man, his partner. They, by the way, my book, The Man Who Killed Kennedy, The Case Against LBJ, will be coming out in September with two new chapters and an afterword. Among the other things I reveal is that Lyndon and Bobby Baker owned an abortion clinic in San Juan, and they owned a travel agency on Capitol Hill. So if a woman became pregnant, she could buy a holiday package at the travel agency that would include her flight, the cost of her illegal abortion, an overnight at a hotel that they owned next to the abortion clinic,
unbelievable,
and the flight back.
Ugh. And I bet they were making a small fortune.
It was a gold mine, but Lyndon used to laugh that he'd really just set it up for his girlfriend's purposes.
Now, was Nixon in Dallas during the assassination?
Yes, and this is something in which there's a lot of historical argument, but let's talk about how he gets there. In 1963, Nixon's completely washed up. He has just lost the 1962 election for governor, meaning he lost the presidency, or it was stolen from him, as we shall talk about here in a bit. But he lost the presidency in 1960, and he lost. He was addicted to the game, and he still wanted to be president. So he decides to grab a large power base by running for governor.
Well, I thought he said, "You're not going to kick Nixon around anymore."
Yeah. So he flames out in that campaign in an upset. He starts ahead, and he ends up getting beat because of the Cuban Missile Crisis. The Cuban Missile Crisis happens a week before the election, sucks all the oxygen out of the room. President Kennedy, who's running the government, summons his governor, Pat Brown, Nixon's opponent, to Washington to discuss the matter. They get enormous coverage of that. Pat Brown wouldn't know the first thing about Cuba. But it takes Nixon down. So he's a two-time loser. He is he's considered dead as Kelsey's nuts, as the Ward boss would say. And he's still nursing, you know, fantasies of being president. So he moves to a law firm in New York. He completely uproots from New York, and he lives in the same building as his arch rival Nelson Rockefeller. And oddly, he goes to work for a law firm whose largest client is Chase Manhattan Bank.
And Rockefeller owned that building, didn't he?
Right. He was a Rockefeller tenant. So of all the apartment houses in New York City, he decides to move to Manhattan to join the sleepy firm of Mudge, Rose, Guthrie, and Alexander, which will now be called Nixon, Mudge, Rose, Guthrie, and Alexander.
So he's there, he's doing his thing. When does he decide, I'm going to run for the presidency again? Two-time loser, but he wants to try again.
See, that's the point here, and that is from the instant that he's losing in 1960, he's already decided to run for president. It's in his DNA. This is my whole point here about Nixon and why this is an admiration. I, as you know, have a tattoo of Nixon on my back. It's about the size of a grapefruit.
That's real, isn't it?
Yes. Between my shoulder blades. And it's not there as an ideological statement. It's there as a daily reminder that in life, when you suffer defeats, when you have disappointments, when things don't go your way, when you just don't know if you can achieve your goals, you have an obligation to get up, dust yourself off, and get back in the game. It's about never quitting. It's that
That's
clip
right.
that you played at the beginning.
Yeah.
You know, a man is not defeated. Pardon me, a man is not finished when he is defeated. A man is finished when he quits.
And he quits.
Richard Milhouse Nixon, a very odd man, but both very great and very flawed. A man who made enormous mistakes, such as taking us off the gold standard, an enormous mistake. Wage and price controls, an enormous mistake.
Bringing in Haig.
The war on drugs, an enormous mistake, an enormous expensive mistake.
Yes.
An enormous, expensive, ineffective mistake.
He had his foreign policy was better than his domestic policy.
Well, I would argue that his domestic policy is very impressive. First of all, he desegregates the schools without violence. You know, it's very fashionable. Last week, Richard Cohn wrote a column for the Washington Post syndication that was run in the New York Daily News about the racism of Nixon's southern strategy. Nixon had a terrible problem in 1960. He didn't know whether to go north or south. Does he try to make inroads with African-Americans in big states like New York and Pennsylvania and Illinois, and kind of go left on the issues of the day, or does he try to invade Dixie and break into the solid South? Remember, Kennedy ends up carrying the entire South. Nixon even loses the border South.
Yeah.
Unlike Nixon Eisenhower, which had swept the border South. So it is a struggle over the South. In 1968, he makes no such mistake. He needs the Southern states, and he plays to them. And what does he tell white Southern Democrats? I'm going to go slow on civil rights. Now, my argument, he turns out to be right. By 15% of the schools are desegregated when he becomes president. That number is 89 when he leaves.
Amazing.
No bloodshed, no violence. Mitchell enforced the law. He called these white citizens' councils and school boards all up to Washington, and he said, we will enforce the law.
And it was done. It was done without a lot of pomp, too. We didn't get that kind of Kennedy-esque problem.
Well, Nixon assigned a working group that included George Shultz and John Mitchell, the very gruff attorney general, who I delivered a lunch for in the 1968 campaign, and who was, I think, a much maligned man. I mean, one of the things about my book is that when it comes to Watergate and a number of the key factors late in Nixon's career, I really depend on a group of really important journalists who are countermanding history. James Rosen from Fox News wrote a book called The Strong Man, a biography of John Mitchell that essentially makes just a very compelling case that Mitchell never approved the Watergate break-in. That is a confection of John W. Dean. It's an important book.
It is, and it sounds like, and with Watergate, we're going to come back to it, but did Nixon in the beginning even know what the heck was going on?
No, and as I will go through with you, my book is out contemporaneously with John Dean's book, and this is a very bad thing for Mr. Dean because he's not squaring with the American people. His new book has 457 individual new tapes, over 1,000 hours of new transcripted tapes that he refuses to submit for third-party review. So we're supposed to take his word for it that this is the way it went down, and then you learn that he either truncates or totally admits the conversations of March 13th, 16th, 17th, and 20th, all before the famous Cancer on the President's Speech of the 21st. Now, every one of these relates 100% to the Watergate cover-up. Why would you remove them, or why would you shorten them? Because they paint a very different picture of John Dean and a very different picture of Richard Nixon than you think.
So when this happens, when Watergate happens, does Nixon try to fight it?
Well, I think it is, to be honest with you, I think it is better for us to take his career chronologically because, as you pointed out at the beginning, if you have to understand what happened to him in 1960 to understand the state of mind that he is in from that point forward.
Okay.
It not only dominates the 68 campaign, but his thinking in Watergate. He is beaten by, he says, the most ruthless band of operators he's ever met. They take him to the cleaners. The filthiest campaign in American history was run by John F. Kennedy and his brother. They printed millions of pieces of virulent anti-Catholic literature and mailed it to Catholic households, making it look like it came from Nixon.
Well, it was dirty, smart politics, wasn't it?
Well, and as we shall see, they wiretapped him. They broke into his psychiatrist. This is Nixon. They broke into Nixon's psychiatrist's office to steal his medical records. They wiretapped his hotel suite on the eve of the Nixon-Kennedy debate. They were eavesdropping on the Republican National Committee.
If only he had worn makeup during that debate, Roger.
Because they faked him out. What happened was Nixon bumped his knee after the Republican National Convention, and he developed a serious staph infection. They told him that he had to get off the leg, and they put him in Walter Reed Hospital, and they pumped him up with antibiotics. And he sat there for 2 weeks while a tanned, good-looking JFK was touring the country running the numbers up. He was chafing at the bit to get out of the hospital and back on the road and get back in the game as he was losing ground, Kennedy becoming better known and surging in the polls. When he comes out, on the way to the debate, he bumps his knee on the car door. So he is seen to grimace in pain. He's 15 pounds underweight. He's still on antibiotics.
He's got the little beard, right?
What happens is they go to the lighting check, which is like a prize fight weigh-in. Kennedy's there. Nixon's there.
Yeah.
Nixon writes in his book, "I never saw him looking so fit." Nixon comes in, but first of all, it's important. He comes roaring out of the hospital. He does 5 rallies in different states on the way to Chicago for the debate and gets in late. Spends 3 hours with ring binders in his hotel room alone and does the debate. When he goes to the weigh-in, all the network brass is there, and the director says, "Senator Kennedy, will you be using makeup?" "No makeup for me, thank you." And Nixon hears this. He says, "Mr. Vice President, makeup?" And Nixon says, "No, I won't be having makeup."
Oh, he tricked him.
Kennedy now goes into his dressing room where he's flown his own makeup man in from New York.
Was he that diabolical?
Yes. No, Bobby was. Bobby and Joe were. Jack Kennedy was probably, he was essentially an affable guy who really just wanted to get laid.
Yeah.
Not a bad fellow. Not a liberal, by the way, by any means. I think an anti-communist.
Hold on, Rog. We're at the break. We're going to come right back. Nixon's Secrets on Coast to Coast AM. And welcome back to Coast. Roger Stone with us, Nixon's Secrets. And we'll start at the chronology of 1960, Roger. And people, you're going to hear a lot of strange things, too. I'll just throw one out. We're going to get to it. Nixon knew Jack Ruby. So, Rog, back to the debates. Kennedy looks fantastic. Nixon looks gaunt, tired, and people would say that.
And Nixon makes an enormous mistake. He believes that the debate will be judged on the basis of substance, and he still thinks Jack Kennedy's a lightweight.
Well, and people that heard them on the radio
thought Nixon had won, but it's his physical appearance. He also begins to sweat profusely, and he essentially melts on camera. Kennedy wears a dark suit. in a white shirt and a dark tie. Nixon wears a light gray suit that's almost the color of his complexion without makeup. He looks, his own mother calls Rosemary Woods and says, is Richard unwell?
Oh, my gosh.
But famously, I believe it was Mayor Daley who said, my God, they've embalmed him and he's not even dead yet.
And Kennedy had Madison Avenue advertising savvy.
Well, but more importantly, just let's go through the chronology. Nixon hits five states on his way there. He gets to Chicago exhausted. Jack Kennedy comes in the late morning. He spends the afternoon with two hookers on the rooftop getting a suntan.
Oh, boy.
You know, he is completely ready because the Kennedy Madison Avenue paid advisors, paid for by his gangster father, the bootlegger Ambassador Joseph P. Kennedy, I mean, a truly evil man, an appeaser of Hitler, man who argues in World War II we're on the wrong side, he is paying for the very best. And the first real modern campaign in America is 1960, the first television built-for-television campaign. And we have this stunning image of John Kennedy, handsome, well-tailored, beautiful wife.
And the media was not what they are today. I mean,
beautiful children. Well, they were in love. It was a social and cultural thing. To be for Nixon, to be for Kennedy, was to be hip.
Yeah, that's right.
It was
right.
To be liberal. It was to be cool and sophisticated. Nixon was the old America. That stuff, the old Eisenhowerism. He's, you know, he's a Rotarian.
Yeah.
He's in the Chamber of Commerce. He appeals to the center of the country, not the coasts. The sophisticates were for Kennedy, and it so misunderstands Nixon in some ways. I mean, people, there's so much they don't know about him. I'll give you several examples. Nixon could not read music, but he could play the saxophone, the clarinet, the accordion, and the piano.
Never knew that.
Nixon worked out an hour and a half every day of his life. He was an absolute advocate of intense exercise, and he watched his diet carefully. He ate very little meat. He ate no pork at all. He ate little beef and was largely vegetarian.
Way before it was in vogue.
Before it was in vogue. It was all about discipline. He had a prodigious memory for facts and figures and faces and names. I worked for Ronald Reagan for 8 years. Every time I saw him, somebody had to tell him who I was. Nixon knew not only my wife's name, but the names of my kids.
Yeah. Yeah.
And he knew which congressional district I lived in.
That's amazing.
He was very retentive, and he was a reader. He loved classical music. He knew it well. He had an extraordinary wine palate and a wide knowledge of wines, both red and white.
Was he?
His cellar in his post-presidential years in Saddle River may have been the best in New Jersey.
Was he a nice person, Roger?
Obviously there are many sides of Richard Nixon. I was so junior when I joined the Nixon entourage that, of course, I didn't get to really know him well in his post-presidential years. In 1968, I became let me back up to Goldwater. Goldwater lost. I was a Goldwaterite at 12 years old. I was wearing a Goldwater button. I was had a Goldwater bumper sticker on my car, on my bicycle. I would go to the Republican headquarters every night and lick stamps and put them on envelopes for Barry Goldwater. And this all started when the woman who lived next door to my home in the suburban Connecticut gave me a book called Conscience of a Conservative. And I read this book and I realized communism was bad, their foreign policy was ridiculous, the government was getting big and more wasteful, and they were eating our civil rights and our liberties. So I became a stalwart Goldwaterite. He lost. I was crushed. I began looking at the 1960 election. I decided when I was about 14 it had been stolen, and I wrote Nixon a letter. He was practicing law in New York City, and I said, you know, they stole it from you. You really should run again. You should try it again.
Amazing.
I got a very nice letter back from him saying, that's very kind, but I'm finished with politics. A lie.
Mm-hmm.
And if I change my mind, we'll be in touch. 2 years later, John Whitaker contacted me. They didn't realize that I was a kid. They thought I was an adult. And they said, are you still interested in a job? Because I basically said, I'm ready to come to work right now. I was 14.
Did you tell them that? You were 14?
Well, by that time, of course, I was old enough to drive. So I took the train into New York City, and I got a job as a gopher, as a driver. I was driving Governor John Davis Lodge, who was their chairman, all over Connecticut.
Amazing.
That's how, and Lodge arranged for me to become an intern in the White House press shop when I went to college. And from there, I so completely brown-nosed Jeb Stuart Magruder.
You did?
Oh, yeah. That's how I got on his staff. He was one of the great weasels of our day. But I, when I was at the White House internship, I brown-nosed my way into getting him to hire me.
And you went.
And I was at the committee to reelect the president as the youngest member of the staff. I was 19, and I later learned that the slot they had budgeted paid $36,000, but Magruder laughed about the fact that he could get me for $22,000.
That's pretty good money then, too, though, wasn't it?
Yes, it was, but yeah. I had a very difficult job.
Yeah.
So, and of course, I had to, unfortunately, they also expected me to, shall we say, moonlight on some other operations. So
anyways, let's go back to 60. November 60, the election's very close.
Yes.
Did Kennedy steal it through Chicago?
Oh, I think it's worse than that. I mean, first of all, it is important to recognize that Nixon makes a series of very serious errors. Not only does he bump his knee, as we've talked about, and botch the first debate, but it's important to recognize that there are three more debates. First debate, it hurts Nixon. The second debate, he comes back strong. He goes on a diet of milkshakes. He starts using a sun lamp. And by the time of the next debate, he's good. By the fourth debate, and there's four, that's the most decisive in which supposedly he really, according to all critics, he really takes Kennedy on.
Uh-huh.
The audience in the fourth debate was almost as large as the third. This is one of the great media myths. Well, yes, Nixon did better in the subsequent debates, but the big audience was all focused on the knockout blow by Kennedy. Not really true. The next three debates really aided Nixon in a comeback. Now, he bungles the Martin Luther King issue. King is arrested in Alabama in the middle of the campaign. Bill Rogers, the attorney general under Eisenhower, and others advise Nixon to call Mrs. King, and Nixon demurs, and it's a mistake.
Big mistake.
They suggest, when they suggest that he call the judge, he says, I'm a member of the bar. Calling the judge is improper. You guys know it. I'm an ex-partite partner. It's not right. Robert Kennedy had no qualms. He calls the judge and says, let this guy go. Totally improper. A total grandstand play.
Yeah. But it worked.
Daddy King, Martin Luther King's father, switches his public support from Nixon. He'd been a Republican, supported Eisenhower and Nixon in 52 and 56. He switches publicly to Kennedy.
Wow.
There's a late shift among African Americans. Nixon still gets a third of the black vote in 1960, a third against the great John F. Kennedy.
That's high. That is high.
Well, first of all, Kennedy should have been suspect on civil rights. He talks a good game, but in the United States Senate in 1957, when there was a civil rights bill, old Lyndon Johnson put a poison pill in there that says if you were convicted of violating the civil rights of a Negro, you were going to be tried before a state jury, which in Mississippi means an all-white jury.
That's right.
Which means no one ever gets convicted of anything. And John Kennedy voted for that amendment. Richard Nixon rounded up Senate Republicans as the presiding officer against that amendment. Nixon's civil rights record is perfect. And those who want to talk about the Southern strategy should look how much money he pumped into black scholarship, black businesses.
Now, in terms of polling, Roger, is Kennedy up or down compared to Nixon as we get close
well,
to the
November? Well, that's the kind of interesting thing. So after this, Nixon, because he cannot, he's at a disadvantage because he doesn't know whether to go north or south. Kennedy and Johnson have an interesting relationship. As those who read The Man Who Killed Kennedy know, John Kennedy had decided on Stuart Symington, the Missouri senator, as his running mate. And he'd already asked Symington. Symington said yes, and he's preparing his acceptance speech. And Lyndon Johnson and Sam Rayburn show up at Kennedy's hotel room late at night. And they have with them some photos. And those photos are from J. Edgar Hoover, and they are Jack Kennedy with various women.
Uh-huh.
And Johnson basically says, now, Jack, I'd hate these to get out. But you need me, you need Texas, and you need me to keep my mouth shut.
Uh-huh.
Or should I just give these to Dick Nixon?
He was that abrupt about this?
I think there's no question. Robert Kennedy's not in the room. He goes wild when he finds out that they've taken Johnson. The Johnsons blackmailed Kennedy. Kennedy is very quiet about it, and he's very embarrassed, but he dumps Symington in the middle of the night.
Are these pictures like with Marilyn and things like
that? J. Edgar Hoover kept a file. He hated the Kennedys. He was a backdoor next neighbor and close political ally.
Well,
Lyndon Johnson's the Senate Majority Leader, Edgar's budget over at the Bureau almost doubles in the appropriations process.
Yeah, but Hoover had files on everybody.
That's absolutely true. Look, Nixon had a long-term relationship with a stunning Chinese woman who turns out to have most likely have been a Chinese communist spy. He meets her in a bar in Hong Kong. They meet a number of times. When the British intelligence services learn this, they let the FBI know, and Hoover authorizes them to photograph Nixon and the hot Asian chick through the windows of his hotel. Then he later tries to use those pictures as leverage on Nixon.
Wow.
By the way, the Asian lady, whose name is Lou, moves when Nixon becomes president, moves to the United States, and first she moves to New York when he's in the New York area, and then she moves to California when he's in the California area.
Did Pat Nixon know what was going on?
I had many opportunities to meet Mrs. Nixon, but that was not one of the issues I wanted to discuss with her.
I understand.
I couldn't tell you.
Okay, so let's click the 16
election. But we do know, by the way, and I think it's important to note that Tennessee Williams writes that Jackie Kennedy told him that one night in the early 50s, when Nixon was vice president and Jack was out of town, that Nixon made a pass at her, tried to get her in the sack.
I can't see him as a womanizer.
Well, I mean, what about the chick in Hong Kong? I mean, this is a very interesting. I just think that there's a lot to him that people don't realize. I think he is a multi-layered personality, and he has a light and dark side. He can be magnanimous and visionary. He can be naive. I'll give you a perfect example. 1952, Louis Armstrong goes out on the road as a goodwill ambassador for the State Department, and the State Department funded tour where Louis's playing his horn in Africa and Asia.
Mm-hmm.
And it's very successful. Life magazine does a full spread on it. Armstrong is a national hero. And he's on the very last trip, when he lands at Idlewild coming back from Asia, for the first time ever, they walk him into the customs line. Previously, they just swept him through customs because he was a State Department guest.
Sure.
Well, Louis knows that he's got 4 pounds of really good weed in his suitcase. And he's on this long line, and he's starting to sweat because he knows they're going to go through his bag. And he's pouring sweat, mopping his brow, and the doors swing open, and in comes Vice President Richard Nixon. And his aides point out that Louis Armstrong is there, and there's news photographers traveling with Nixon, a whole horde of reporters. So they gather around Nixon, and Nixon walks up to Satchmo and says, "What's going on, Satch?" And Armstrong says, "Well, Pops, I just came in from Asia, and I'm going to wait for customs." Nixon looks at him and says, "U.S. ambassadors don't have to go through customs. Let the vice president carry that bag." He picks up Louis's bag and walks him out to the curb where Louis hops in his waiting car and is driven away. So when Nixon is told this story, Nixon is ultimately told the story. One of Louis's entourage, a jazz musician, black guy, told the comedian Pete Barbeauty, who told the story to me, when Nixon is told later the story, many years later, he looked at me and said, "Louis smoked marijuana?"
I knew somebody who knew Louis, a little old lady now, and she absolutely confirms what you say about what he did. He smoked it and smoked
every day of his life. He was a jazz musician in the 20s and 30s.
When he played it, 99% of the time he was high.
Oh, of course. He was a bebop musician. He was one of the greatest trumpetists who ever lived.
Yep, sure was. Okay, so the election's held. He loses.
He doesn't just lose. First of all, Joe Kennedy has deep ties into the Northeastern mob because he's been
a rum runner.
He's partners with Frank Costello. They control all of the alcohol in New England into the state of New York. The Kennedy brings the Massachusetts New England Park, and Costello has Long Island and the city, and they're partners. But he's not close to the Chicago mob, so he goes right into the mouth of the beast. He flies out to see Sam Giancana and the boys in a sit-down, and he basically says, "My son's going to be president. I want $1 million. And they kind of laugh, and he didn't. And the old man says, "Look, you, Carlos Marcello, they're trying to deport you. Santo Traficante, the boss of Florida, they're trying to deport you. My son gets in. That goes away. I need $1 million. Makes the deal. And the mob is muscling voters. They work hand-in-hand with the Daily Machine because, as the subsequent report shows, they have great overlap. The mob is, you know, sitting at Daily's table. So they steal Nixon blind, and I have a great deal of detail in the book of the precinct numbers. You know, you'd have a precinct with 862 voters that voted 1,600 for Kennedy and 22 for Nixon.
And it was a very close national vote, wasn't it?
It was a blatant steal, but the real point here is the real thievery, the real stealing was going on below the Mason-Dixon line. Lyndon Baines Johnson steals the Nixon Lodge ticket blind in Texas. You see, here's how they did it. In Texas in those days, the ballot worked like this. There'd be a list of all the candidates, and you had to cross out the ones you were not for.
Not for. Okay.
Not for. If you circled the one that you were for, the most logical thing, your ballot would be thrown out. If you were in a county controlled by Lyndon Johnson, if you were in the other counties, your vote would be counted. So there's an uneven standard.
Mm.
They throw out these votes. They throw out 54,000 of these in Dallas County. LBJ has them quickly burned. There can be no recount. Burned.
Wow.
The Nixon Lodge ticket only carries Texas by 46,000 votes. Texas and Illinois together rob Nixon of the presidency. So many, a number of analysts have said, well, maybe Chicago was stolen, maybe it wasn't, but even if it was, it wouldn't have made the difference. No, but Chicago and Texas does make the difference.
It does make it. And these were electoral votes, right?
These were electoral votes. So, yeah. So if people say, well, Nixon was paranoid. You would be paranoid, too, if a wealthy gangster and his playboy son stole the presidency from you.
Why didn't Nixon's people do that?
First of all, Republicans were never good at vote stealing. This is a myth. The Republican organization knew how to steal. The Republican Party ground troops are school teachers and retired librarians. It's a middle-class party. We're not, you know, the way the Democrats move mobs is if a 300-pound guy stands outside the polling place and says, you're voting for Kennedy, right?
Yeah, yeah, and they did that.
Well, he'll go in the booth with you to make sure. I mean, that's how the mob stole Chicago. It's not just transposing numbers, although Daley's boys are good than that. I mean, there were more votes cast for Kennedy than there were registered voters in many of these districts.
And how come I heard this story a long time ago, Roger? How did that happen? How did I hear stories that Kennedy stole Chicago?
Well, because there was a series of stories that were really quite authoritative in the New York Herald Tribune, and there was a major movement among Republicans to demand a recount, and I think, in all fairness, Nixon thought about it. And I think initially he kind of liked the idea because he was still angry and hurt and stunned. This is an election he was supposed to win, but you asked about the polling. It's very interesting that Nixon still bounces back at the end of this race to close fast and win. The reason, I think, is because the Kennedys were spending balls out from day one. Nixon had more finite money, so he saved it. He hoarded it.
Mm-hmm.
And he had more television on the air and more radio in the closing 30 days than Kennedy did. Plus, Eisenhower went out on a tour. Now, people say, well, if Dick had asked Eisenhower to go to the stump for him, he would have won, but he never asked Ike. The truth of the matter is he badly needed Eisenhower, but Mamie Eisenhower backdoors the general, comes to Pat Nixon and says, you know, Ike is ill, he's got a heart condition, please don't ask him to campaign.
Stay with us, Raj. More to come in just a moment on Coast to Coast AM.